session number 10596, rule 4.
Group Captain Mahadi, rule 4.
Yeah. Which accounts, I'm saying, which accounts really for 40% of the lifted weight, and 60% are not on the bomb plot at all.
So you're saying 20% are on the target, 20% on the periphery,
yeah,
and 60% nowhere near, approximately.
No, I'm saying that. Now, you can change that figure because I'm guessing, and this is what I say in my lecture, my bombing years, but I would love to come up, if you would make an assessment yourself. I'm not giving you a bit of homework, but that's making the thing look really authentic. Roger?
Yes, fine. So how does this fit in with your recruiting?
Right. So, I would look at this, and I would... I examine this bomb plot. And I say to myself that, oh, P-37, I've seen him before. And I look up just the previous. And I find that P-97, I have a little staff, a corporal. I'm in with P-4, which is aircrew posting. And I have a very, very sound man, a bank manager that kicked the traces over and came out of the... They were screened. They didn't join up. And my corporal was a first class, and he was something of an analyst, you know. And he said, yes. And he used to keep a tally of people. And he says, yes, he's got aiming point pictures. There are 3, 4, and he looked up, and he said he's got 6 aiming point pictures. And I would ring up the squadron and say, who's the chap? I'm sorry. Who's the chap? Who's the skipper of your aircraft last night, P? He said, oh, that's Sergeant Snodgrass. And so I would make an arrangement to go to that squadron to lecture about the Pathfinders. And I would ask the CO about this fellow. I said, oh, I'm going to commission him. You can't have him. And then I had overriding authority to take who I wanted. Given to me by Bomber Command, by Harris, through Bennett. And so that was my main source. You see, and as we got through 43, we were getting many, many second tour people coming back, and strangely enough, they all wanted to come back to the Pathfinders.
Why?
I don't know why. By this time, we were getting better results, and maybe a chap didn't want to be amongst the Carter Pattersons, you know, the heavy furniture removers. They wanted to be Pathfinders because they only got a little 4-penny badge on their pocket, and that was all they got. But this made my job very much easier.
But didn't the CEOs of the squadrons put obstacles in there?
Oh, yes. And the next thing that happened, they said, well, we'd better go and see the station commander about that. Now, I said, I don't know who started this, I said that I have Pathfinder priority. I have priority to pick who I want. And command said, yeah, well, he has, you see. So if the station commander went back to group, and group went to command, I said, well, you know, that's the policy. He has. And I could override station commanders, group commanders. Mind you, it didn't do me a great deal of good at the time. But then once people realized that I could do this, in any case, if there was a very serious objection, and I didn't want to stop the... You see, I would commission these fellows almost immediately. When they'd done, say, half a dozen trips with me, I said, I promise you, you'll be commissioned. And this is my plea, and I saw to it that they were commissioned. Chaps that came to me with acting rank from an OTU, an operational training unit, they said, I shall lose my scraper, you know, the little ring in the middle when there were squadron leaders. I said, no, you won't. You will come with your acting rank and you'll stay with that. And so that made it very easy for me. And I had tremendous powers as a wing commander, as I was at the time. And then even more powers when I became a station commander, training them all at War Boys. And see, I have a station commander in 5 group, 1 group, 4 group, or 3 group, ring him up and say, Hamish, you've just posted this lad. You know, he's acting, he's a flight sergeant, but he's really acting flight commander. I said, well, why haven't you promoted him? Why haven't you commissioned him? And they said, well, we were going to. There's always manana, manana. And I could force them to. I said, well, right, all right. I've got this fellow fitted in. We will commission him, and he'll probably be a flight commander in a very short period if he survives. And so there's no argument about this. All right, Hamish. And then gradually people didn't bother because they knew that I was, you know, that I had the authority. But it wasn't the authority of Pathfinder Priority. I don't know who started that. It wasn't me.
But did the COs resort to dirty tricks on you to
frequently
retain their...
Frequently.
Can you name any?
No, I wouldn't name...
I don't mean the individual.
No.
Can you name any of the dirty
tricks? I can't recall any that would name. But I'll tell you, I wasn't very friendly with Guy Gibson. This is a typical answer to your question. Guy Gibson was a very, very fine operational commander. One of the best at the time. And I say in my book about him that there was nobody better for the dams raid at that particular time. I know of half a dozen, maybe a dozen chaps that had done the dams raid just as easily. Maybe not survived the raid, but just as easily as Guy Gibson. But Guy Gibson was in season. And that might be the wrong phrase, but he was right at the time and there was nobody else about. That's what I'm trying to say. He was in season, a man of his time for the job. And I was very friendly with Cocky Cochrane.
Yeah, what were you going to say about Guy Gibson in relation to your own?
Yeah, well, I was just going to say this, that I was very friendly with Cocky Cochrane, and he had a rule in 5 Group. He says, if Mahadi ever comes to my headquarters, bring him to me at once. Because he used to have arguments with Bennett through me about a change in tactics or doing something else, you see. But he and I were very friendly. I was his blue-eyed boy in 3 Group, you see, when he commanded the Pathfinders. And so, I'm having tea or a coffee with Cocky Cochrane, and Gibson is introduced. And Gibson comes in, and Cocky says, do you know Mahadi? And Gibson, we weren't friendly because of crews I'd been snatching when he commanded 106 Squadron. Long before he got command of 617 wasn't in being at that time, at that particular moment. And he said, yes, I know Mahadi. We have a chat. But before Gibson came in, he handed me a sheet of paper with about the names of about, I can't remember exactly, say 20 pilots. 20 pilots' names. He said, Hamish, you do me a great favor. You won't steal any of those names. In the near future. And I gave them a pledge. I said, no. They said, I didn't even look at them, you see. And I put the note in my pocket. Now, when I got outside the door with Gibson, when we'd had a cup of coffee, Gibson turned on me, and he was very offensive. And he said, and I won't repeat what he said, it would offend you too. And you leave my bloody cruise alone. And don't you dare touch Searby. Now, I'd never heard of Searby, John Searby. Well-known Peenemunde, master bomber. Very well-known bomber, dead now. And he'd never come through on the bomb plot, that I remember, because I rang up my office, and I made no comment about that. So that night we met in the Black Boy. But in the meantime, I had found out that Searby wasn't on Cocky's Chit, and there was no sign of him on the more recent. I don't know how far back my corporal went, but there was no sign of Searby on the bomb plot, so it didn't come up in our thinking at all. And so in with the Black Boy in Nottingham, he bought me half a pint of beer, and he didn't repeat exactly his threat about what would happen to me if I stole any of his crews, because I thought the list that Cocky gave me was about 106 Squadron. I had no idea. I knew nothing about 617 Squadron. Not a thing about 617 Squadron. And so we were more or less friendly in the Black Boy. But in the interim, I'd been through to my bank manager in P4 at Huntingdon, my office at Huntingdon, and I said, post Searby, we wanted a squadron commander. He was a flight commander, acting flight commander in 106 Squadron. We wanted a squadron commander for 83 Squadron, and John Searby just moved straight in. And funnily enough, from the time he became a pathfinder, he was always getting aiming point pictures, and he was the master bomber on that great Peenemunde raid, which made him eventually an air commodore, and he got a first class DSO for the job. Now, at the same time that was happening, there was a guy, and I'm thinking of the name, there was a guy in War Boys, my training establishment, who'd come from Five Group, and he was on Cocky's list. But I knew nothing about this, and I'm trying to remember who's the 617 Squadron fellow that's all living.
Shannon.
The one?
Shannon.
Shannon. Dave Shannon. Dave Shannon. Now, I was up in Nottingham. I was in one of the stations that night. When I come down back to Huntingdon, I was discussing this list with my P4, he said, "Oh, we've had a posting notice in for Shannon. He's at War Boys." So I said, "Well, I promised Cocky." We rang up War Boys, and he had disappeared overnight. Guy Gibson whistled him out in the dead of night, right from under my nose. So that was the sort of, you know, jiggery-pokery that was going on all the time. And I was as good at it as anybody, because I had no scruples about the best. The best was only just good enough for the pathfinders. And this is something that Dave Shannon and I have a little joke about. We meet regularly in your reunions and places. And he was actually starting his pathfinder training. And Guy Gibson whipped him out. But he was on Cocky's list. And I never kept that Cocky list, I'm sorry. I would like to have published it. because I tell this story in my book.
Now, you were saying that Cochrane was a good friend of yours, reading Pathfinder, which is Don Bennett's autobiography, he has some hard words to say about Cochrane there.
He does, and they were very... I'm trying to think of the proper phrase to use. They were quite unfair. Cocky was a superb, run-of-the-mill Air Force officer of his time. Not Bennett, of course, had been. Bennett was Point Cook, Australian Cranwell, and then the Australian Air Force couldn't cope with them, and offered them to the Air Force, and they took a short service commission. But he was a fighter boy. He was at North Weald, for Christ's sake. Fighter boy on Gamecocks or Siskins or something like that. You know, round about 29-30 period. Before he went to flying boats with Harris. And so he was very unfair. Gradually, it wasn't the same sort of thing that was in the Battle of Britain with the two group commanders. You know, the history of the Battle of Britain was terrible. The two group commanders.
You mean Dowding and Lee Mallory?
No. Dowding was the commander in chief. Lee Mallory and the other fellow, the New Zealander. What was his name?
Yes, I know.
11 group. Anyway, these were two, but the blame for that was entirely on Badr. Nothing to do with Lou Murray, because Lou Murray was an arch bastard. He was a very, very unpopular person. And he took his time from Badr. It was Badr, a squadron leader at the time. And Lee Mallory backed him to the hilt. And that's why he was fighting with the 11 group. And they were daggers drawn. It wasn't like that with Bennett. Cocky was trying to tell Bennett, who was was in a different league. Apart from anything else, Cocky, I doubt if Cocky had 2,000 flying hours, and Bennett had 10,000. And he wasn't a first-class navigator, and he wasn't all the other things. Certainly didn't have a single A, B, C, or D category engineer's license and all the other things.
But one of the complaints which Bennett makes in his book about Cochrane is that Harris showed favouritism all the time towards Cochrane. Is this true?
Yeah, that is absolutely true. And I'll tell you another factor of that. The one person who was a great source of comfort, it's the only thing I can use in this period in Bomber Command, was Sonby. And Sonby was the deputy chief, and he was a delightful character, and he was very much in favour of what the Air Ministry wanted at the time, and tried, and he had to be very careful. Very volatile figure and character was Harris, you see. And they'd been... Harris had commanded a squadron in Iraq in the late 20s, and Cochrane and Sonby were his two flight commanders. And Sonby always said, if ever there was a conflict of interest, Harris always sided with Cochrane and never... And he said, it's the same now. If I go to him with a plea about Cochrane, 5 group and 8 group, he always came down on the side of Cochrane. And this... And I don't know how. And here, I'm giving you a personal opinion. I don't know how Sid Bufton, is going to handle this, because he was on the butt of Harris's venom for a long time, because he was the one that plugged, and he was the one that persuaded the chief of staff, the chief of their staff, to give Harris an order, a positive, or it got down to that. And he said, over my dead body will we have a Pathfinder force? Will we have a core elite? And we weren't. We came in with no more clues than the main force, except we had more experience. And we were all second tour people. So we had some advantage, but we had no skills.
Now, can I go on to a different issue, which is one which is often raised by people nowadays about the morality of Bomber Command's campaign, because people talk about the campaign of area bombing as though it's an immoral thing.
Yeah.
What are your own feelings about these criticisms?
Very clear. And they're Harris's and Bennett's, and everybody that looked at the thing, really, when you think that we were the only people in the whole stretch of the war years that were able to go and hurt the enemy very poorly, just a slap up to end of 42, and then from then on we could hurt them severely. They were hurting us at the same time. Oh no, I have no scruples at all. Now again, maybe it's an illustration. In Australia, one of the new Australians, of which there are tens of thousands in Australia, they're called new Australians, Germans, Lithuanians, Polish, everything. A German woman got up in my bombing years and said, "How could you justify going and bombing cities and killing women and children?" She forgot to say we also killed technicians and police and soldiers and airmen home on leave, etc. How could you bear with that? And before I could answer that, a real dinkum Aussie stood up and he said, "I can answer that better than..." He knew me, he was one of my lads, you see, but I didn't put him up to it. He said, "I can answer that better. You must remember that the British government gave the opportunity for all our wives and children to be evacuated as far away, down to Devon and Cornwall, to Scotland, and some went overseas to Canada." I said, "But Hermann Göring said, not one bomb, call me Meyer, call me Jew, if one bomb falls on the Reich..." And this is at the time when a lot of bombs are falling on the Reich. And they had no evacuation except when things like Hamburg happened. They denuded Hamburg. People then left the city because there was no bloody Hamburg to stay in. As simple as that.
Another criticism that's made of Bomber Command is that that although this tremendous effort was put into the bombing offensive, the strategic offensive, that German munitions production continued to go up.
It did. There's no argument about that. You can see that in the graphs, very, very clearly illustrated. You're getting a lot of homework here, so you'll have to look at the. Yes, you see that quite clearly. But I'll tell you how that happened. Is over 1 million able-bodied people from Holland, Belgium and France were drafted into Germany. So it's only a question of killing a few German munition workers. They just put another trainload of them from France, Belgium, Holland. That's how they were able to do it. But then towards the end, of course, that rule didn't hold up, because we were bombing these areas bigger, better than we were doing originally. And also there was one factor right at the beginning of the war, and I can remember this in 1939, the Ministry of Economic Warfare said, "Your one target is oil. Go for oil and you will dry up the ability of aircraft and MT and tanks to operate." You must find oil and bomb oil and destroy oil. Seek and destroy. That was the old naval adage way back in the 1480s. Seek and destroy. And so, but we couldn't find oil. If you can gouge a hole in a hillock 100 feet high with trees on top, and you can put an oil refinery in there, and it wasn't until the Tiffies in the 2nd Tactical Air Force got on the continent, and our agents, and by this time our agents were even putting markers or setting a haystack on fire on the top, and that was the target. And we could put our 1,200 pound bombs right through the bloody earth into the factory. And I was in Germany within hours of the end of the war. Cocky offered me a selection of jobs. He was the Commander-in-Chief of Transport Command. And the day after the war finished, his SPSO, his senior personnel officer, rang me up and said, the Commander-in-Chief would like you to take command of 3 jobs he gave me. And I tell this story in my book. And I, after consideration, I chose to go to Germany. And I commanded a transport wing because all the viaducts were down and bridges were down and we could only resupply with Dakotas. And I had 96 Dakotas based in England at Benson, a Canadian wing based at Benson. But I was now the British European Airways in occupied Germany and Europe between Oslo in the north and Brussels in the south, Prague in the east, and Valkenburg in the west, Holland. So I had this vast area and I controlled, it was 111 wing, transport wing, and all the transport went on and it was all organized. I had a little, it was a wing, it was a sort of miniature group. Well, instead of everybody being group captains, they were all squadron leaders or wing commanders. It was a reduced in number. I wasn't an air officer, I was a group captain, a very acting group captain. Probably I was a substantive, real flight lieutenant, but I was a group captain.
When you saw the German sitters yourself at first hand,
yes.
What kind of impact did it make on you?
It made a very serious impact on me. I thought, Christ, how could they stand up to all this? You know, you go to a place, like Hamburg.